The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I think what America wants to know, Emily, above all, is how do you get to watch TV for a living? How do you get to be a TV critic? How did this happen to you?
It is a scam that I have pulled off to my satisfaction. But at the same time, the amount of television has grown so substantially that all TV critics do is complain.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Whenever I read an essay by Emily Nussbaum about some new show, I know I've got a lot more TV to watch. Emily brings this incredible level of insight and intelligence to her writing. And at the same time, there's always a quality there that's best described as joy. Emily writes all the time in The New Yorker, but she also has a new book coming out called I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. It's not just a collection of reviews. What the book does is articulate Emily's unique point of view on the medium. I caught up with Emily Nussbaum last week. I think it's important for people to know that what you set out to be was a scholar of Victorian literature.
Well, the truth is, I roamed around a little bit for a while before that. But it's true that I was in graduate school. I had a plan to write my dissertation on the public woman, the overlapping categories of actress, Jewess, and prostitute. So that's what the world was spared, is that dissertation. I was very obsessed with Daniel Deronda. I had a lot going on. But
now, do I have it right that the reason that academia does not have you as a member is not because you were weak in Victorian studies, but because you got a horrible kidney infection and you got derailed and that headed you into the direction of television criticism?
I don't think we have to choose between these things. I mean, the truth is, I got a kidney infection. I landed in the hospital. It was during the week of finals. And it basically gave me a moment to pause and say, what am I doing?
Now, what kind of TV watcher were you growing up and until this time as a budding academic or would-be academic?
Well, as a kid, I liked to watch TV in the way that a lot of kids did in the 70s when I was a little kid and in the 80s. And I had shows that I loved. I loved MASH. I loved WKRP. I loved Taxi. I loved a lot of sitcoms, actually. Mm-hmm. And I actually have fond memories, as many people do, of shows that they watched when they were a little kid, when their brain was open to stuff in a different way. I remember I used to be very nice for babysitters, so they let me stay up and watch The Love Boat and Fantasy Island when that was the big...
Hot stuff.
Yes. And actually, it did seem really perverted.
Kind of hot, like Love American Style in a slightly earlier day.
That was fantastic.
Oh,
I have
man.
A great fondness for Love American Style. And also for... There was actually an Aftermath version of that called Undressed on MTV. So if anyone's listening and they remember Undressed,
I
it was an
that.
Amazing show
I'm
that had...
I'm for the archives.
Yeah. I like, you know, it's one of the things about TV was that it had, I think... It was both clean and mass culture-ish, and it had this titillating, slightly dirty candy element to it.
But TV criticism growing up, at least in my memory, especially in some place like the New York Times, was that television was essentially, as my parents used to call it, the idiot box, except there was this thing called PBS. There was this, you know, quality, you know, classical music concerts, British television series based on Dickens or Trollope or Austin or something like that.
There was that. Do you remember that Saturday Night Live
skit
where it was
chunk.
Like Tales of Ribaldry?
And so you would read these very stern, unfun columns of TV criticism. I won't name any names that were somewhat on that basis. They were better than that. I mean, some sitcoms got over a certain bar, but that's the way television was considered until when?
Well, I First of all, I do think that there was some interesting television criticism that was written in the early decades of TV. It just came from a different perspective. I mean, nobody was thinking about TV as art. And when there were clever writers who would respond to TV, or sometimes intellectual writers who would respond to it, they would respond to it as a social symptom. I mean, when I read older TV criticism, which I sometimes do because, I mean, when I got this job, I actually went into the archives and went all the way back and tried to reach some of the earlier stuff, which was extremely illuminating. But one of the main things is that, first of all, a lot of people who covered television for newspapers were covering it both as an industry and writing reviews.
Right.
And frankly, that matched with what TV seemed like, which was a place that drew no distinction between whether a show got high ratings and was good for advertisers and whether it was a good show. It was just a commercial product. It was not talked
exceptions
about.
There might have been some exceptions. A guy like Tom Shales at the Washington Post.
Oh, absolutely.
In the, I guess, what, the early 70s and the 80s, did have a sense of fun. Saturday Night Live, he completely got onto, and various other shows.
Yeah. I'm in no way suggesting that there were fun, good writers about it. But a sense of shame hovered over the entire industry that I think afflicted the ability of people to respond to it as critics because it wasn't taken seriously. It was something that people were embarrassed about. And that included people who love television. They still had to talk about it, essentially the whole thing of it, as a guilty pleasure.
Right.
All of TV.
And when they were complimenting it, it would be almost as good as a novel.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. They would talk about it. Any praise for TV doubled as condescension a lot of the time, because if TV did anything even mildly ambitious, it deserved a pat on the head. And a lot of times, and this is true in the modern era, as TV began to expand and get more ambitious and change for a lot of reasons, including changing technology. But the main way of praising a television show was saying it wasn't like television, that it was more like a book, that it was more like a movie. And part of what I'm writing about in this book is trying to detach TV from that ancient sort of shadow of shame that hovered over it, and that reflexive phenomenon of saying TV is only good when it's not TV-like. My writing is about celebrating TV as TV.
Something happened. I mean, I like to watch your one of the great, funny, dirty titles of any book. It's just fantastic. But I like to watch, in some measure, is about individual shows, but it's also about what's now commonly called the golden age of television. So what happened to set that off? A lot of people will say, well, The Sopranos happened.
I love The Sopranos. I think The Sopranos is a brilliant television show. But I think that one of the ways in which The Sopranos was praised has to do with this attitude toward television. When people praised The Sopranos, and when people talked about HBO, whose slogan was, it's not TV, it's HBO, it was a way of praising something as transcending television. And I was watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer at the same time as I was watching The Sopranos. I love that show equally. And it's about a teenage girl who has these special powers to fight the forces of darkness. It doesn't look very good, especially at the beginning. It was made in a very TV way, visually. It didn't look like a movie. But it's essentially a myth. It's a beautiful, expansive fairy tale myth with a dark side that's about sex and mortality and feminism and, to me, these very substantive issues. And I think it's a very aesthetically ambitious show. And there was no language to talk about the ways in which Buffy was ambitious. The language to talk about The Sopranos was there, and I feel like it magnetized a lot of attention in a way that made it difficult, even in the years past the show, as it started being imitated in various ways. It made it harder for people to talk about the wide range of TV, to talk about comedy, to talk about network TV, to talk about soap opera-like things. There were all of these embedded, hierarchical, class-based biases that inflected a lot of the conversation about TV. And this book and some of my writing is meant as a corrective, and the way in which I've combined my pieces together is meant to make a kind of argument for abandoning that status anxiety.
Now, one of the distinguishing features you say in your book, not just implicitly but explicitly, is that The Sopranos is essentially a male-centered show, and that there was a gender prejudice at work here when you're making a distinction between quality, non-quality, Sopranos, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Gender is part of it, but it's not the whole thing. What I'm talking about is a set of qualities that people reflexively praise versus a set of qualities that people reflexively condescend to. And some of the qualities that The Sopranos had were that it was cinematic. It seemed like a movie rather than TV. That it was about violence rather than sex, so it made it seem substantive. That it was about a middle-aged man who seemed like a character that was a weighty character with gravitas. And that it was made by a singular creator, which made it seem auteurist. And also, I think the fact that show...
But I could almost hear that auteur,
yeah,
David Chase, leaping through the microphone to say, well, wait a minute. It was also, it was a very capacious show, as many seasons and many hours long. And a lot of the characters who were most interesting were women.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Look, I have a piece in there that basically calls The Sopranos one of, I mean, it deserves its reputation as an incredible show. My problem is not with The Sopranos. It absolutely has fantastic characters.
It's the diminishing of the
other things.
Right.
It's the way that the gravity of The Sopranos, the magnetism of The Sopranos, essentially blotted out other shows. Or the fact that there was essentially a ladder where I've written a piece every year about how much I hate top 10 lists. I'm a person who doesn't like hierarchies. I basically want a way to celebrate both The Sopranos and something like Buffy.
So one of the big themes, both in this book and certainly in this golden age of television, is the rise of the antihero. That's a big figure and set of figures in television. What is the lineage of it, and where did it go?
Well, I mean, a lot of people would talk about the original antihero on television, or the most significant antihero, as Tony Soprano. I actually have a piece in my book that talks about Archie Bunker. And it talks about Norman Lear, who's this huge hero to me and big influence on me. But it also talks about something pretty complicated about All in the Family, which was one of the most popular shows. I mean, it was the most popular show in the country, and people loved Archie Bunker, who was a bigot, who was also lovable, who was complicated and funny, and split the audience in half in terms of their responses to him.
So who are the key anti-hero figures of the Golden Age?
Obviously, people talk about Tony Soprano as an anti-hero, Walter White on Breaking Bad,
sure,
and Don Draper. I think that's all true. And I think that those shows, which formed these kind of volumes about masculinity that came out starting around the turn of the century, are this extremely significant change on TV. And one of the things they did that previous TV hadn't been able to do is put this central character on TV that simultaneously attracted and alienated people. So I think those shows are valuable and important. But I also do think that they had some of the effect that Archie Bunker had, which is they split the way the audience responded to them. And I
but
really
you just
noticed
mentioned
this.
Three men. Is it,
yes.
is it an all-male category?
No. I wrote a whole piece about how Carrie Bradshaw on Sex and the City is actually an unclaimed antihero. I actually feel like she as a character was designed to have a very similar effect on the audience that I feel like viewers often reacted with this mixture of identification and distress at her behavior, because she also was designed to create this model of ambivalence and anxiety rather than be a hero that you could root for who was wonderful. But one of the things that those shows did is they smashed open the door for the kinds of characters that could disgust and confuse audiences in ways that were artistically meaningful. And for women especially, like, there have been a million different characters in the aftermath that are also characters that behave poorly but are terrifically charismatic. Fleabag is a recent show that has a character who behaves like a complete jerk in many ways, is also extremely lovable and fascinating, and her charisma is destabilizing to audiences. But she's just one example. The main thing that I have to say about those shows is that what's very freeing about those anti-hero shows at the beginning of the century is they were all created largely by middle-aged men. As the result of them having the privilege to actually get those shows made and the personal force and creativity to make these kinds of changes for TV, they actually freed people up to be able to imagine other kinds of people doing that. And the last few years have marked a huge level of just improved inclusiveness in the kind of stories that got told on TV. This is exciting.
And inclusiveness of those who are making it.
Yeah. Inclusiveness. I mean, obviously, it's not a fixed situation. There's still plenty of sexism in TV. But a lot of the best shows of the last few years have just been straightforwardly made by women and people of color. I mean, that's...
Who would be exemplary of this?
For me, the breakthrough year, I always say this, was there was this year on ABC when Shonda Rhimes, Kenya Barris, and John Ridley were all making television shows. They're all African-American creators, and their shows, Scandal, Black-ish, and American Crime, this very serious drama, could not have been more different from one another. And so none of them had to be the black showrunner on right. ABC. To me, that's
the
ideal.
Carry the weight of everything.
Yeah, carry the weight of the whole thing. So that's the ideal.
I'm talking with Emily Nussbaum, The New Yorker's television critic, and she's just published a book called I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. Now, Emily, what else set off what's now considered the golden age? What's the role of technology in this, for example?
Okay. To me, a lot of what happened since the turn of the century in terms of the changes in TV, some of them have to do with the fact that a group of people grew up within the art form and they had a lot of resistance to the rules of it and they wanted to violate it. But a lot of it has to do with things like DVRs. Suddenly, TV, which had originally been something that would just sort of extrude into your living room like cookie dough and then disappear. It was a disposable, superficially live thing, even though it was taped. It was a text that you could save, rewind, and share with people. You could pause it. People don't even remember this, but it was a radical change. It basically meant that you could make shows that had a certain kind of visual beauty or density, needed to be decoded, needed to be revisited. You couldn't do that before. Before that, when you created TV, it had to be extremely simple. People had to know what they were looking at immediately. It couldn't bore or confuse you. It couldn't upset you enough to turn it off. Like, it actually had to have certain simple qualities. Once the technology changed, it could expand in its ambition in really remarkable ways. Shows could get slower, faster. Cable changed things, and then the internet. There would not be modern television in the way there is without the internet.
Because?
Because it changed the way the audience interacted with shows. I mean, to me, one of the things I love the most about TV is the unique relationship that it has with the audience. And I say this as a fan of a show.
Well, like, you were in on this really early. You were involved with something called Television Without Pity. What was that?
Television Without Pity was this batshit site that was filled with threads on every television show imaginable, from The West Wing and Buffy to a lot of reality shows. It began as a site because there were a group of people online who watched Dawson's Creek and were perpetually frustrated that it was such a bad show, and it sort of that it should be better, but they were passionate hate watchers. And from that grew this enormous site. And it had people from Hollywood, it had journalists, it had all sorts of regular TV watchers. And 24 hours a day, it was people yammering about shows in enormously granular and Talmudic ways. Like, just, you know, threads about hating things, threads about loving things, different relationships. When I was in graduate school, I was on Television Without Pity all the time. And to me, this was actually the basis for my idea of television criticism. Television criticism as a passionate argument, television criticism as something related to fanhood, even if it was being critical of a show. There was a kind of emotional attachment and a kind of freewheeling gonzo voice. It was great.
Was there a critic model for you? I know you get compared a lot, and it's hardly an insult to Pauline Kael, and probably that's because you're a woman, you write for The New Yorker, there's a very personal, direct mode of address that both writers take on. I think you don't completely love the analogy, though.
I have no problem with the analogy. I mean, it is a compliment. People love
it.
And I see the things that we have in common. The only thing I always say in response is there are a lot of TV critics I know who came from a background in writing about movies. I did not. I came to writing about TV because I love TV. I don't have a film studies background. And when I was growing up, I occasionally read The New Yorker, so I probably read her reviews, but I'm not someone who was directly influenced by her. If I named writers that I was directly influenced by, they're often not arts critics.
Who would they be?
Grace Paley. I read Grace Paley very aggressively, and I loved the specificity and strangeness of her voice. I loved Nora Ephron. When I was in college, I read Mary Gaitskill. It's funny, I'm always asked to name, there are critics
right.
that I love, but I was not planning to write criticism. It seemed mean. So I was trying to avoid it, but obviously I failed or became meaner.
Obviously, sociology, economics, historical moment influence art tremendously. In the 19th century, novels were 900 pages long for a reason. They were serialized. They had a certain class's attention every evening without competition from radio or television or movies. And as a result, to some extent, the art itself, whether it's Crime and Punishment or Little Dorrit or what have you, took on a shape that was commensurate with the demands of the audience, meaning I want to read this thing and have it be long and stretch out over a long period of time. Technology has now changed in television so radically, and there's so much of it. There's so much of it being made in multiple seasons. And all. You're a television critic. You do this for a living. Most people, they work all day long, or they're raising their kids, and they're tired at the end of the day, and television is this thing they treat themselves to for an hour or two or three. Is there too much? Is the technology that's available now in danger of exhausting itself and us?
Yes, there is too much TV for my purposes, yeah. Because I can't keep up with stuff. But I have to say, one of the really wonderful things about the way the TV has changed is that, you know, when I was growing up, there were three networks. And then for a while, there were a handful of cable channels. It's definitely confusing. It's overwhelming. But one of the things that I love about the changes in TV as an industry, as a distribution method, is the fact that there's the possibility of survival of shows that are only ever going to reach a small audience. It used to be that unless a show could go mass, it would die. And now there's the possibility of strange things and weird shows that were never designed to be must-see TV for everyone to actually exist and survive. And sometimes they only live for a short time. That's fine with me.
There was even shows that everybody who's listening to this knows the name of. Veep. Mm-hmm. Girls.
Yeah.
The audience is actually quite small.
I mean, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was one of my favorite shows the last few years. It was the last show on the list. The fact that it survived for three seasons is a miracle. But, you know, TV economics are bananas. I always say 30 Rock was one of my favorite shows. The only reason it survived was that NBC was failing. Like, NBC was in such bad shape that they couldn't cancel 30 Rock. So thank God for that, because we all got so much more. So I feel like listing off the names of these small shows that I'm grateful that despite the fact that they got low ratings, they were allowed to exist for long enough to speak to their audience.
But now the industry is poised to not become more streamlined, but bigger. So you've got Disney is about to explode along with Hulu. You've got Netflix doesn't get any smaller. Apple is going, you know, has a lot of auspices the gears are starting and what happens to the networks?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I have this go-to thing that I always say, if I knew anything about economics, I would never have gone into arts criticism. And so nobody should consult me about what networks should do in their business models. But it is fascinating. I remember I was writing, there's a couple of profiles in the book, and I was writing a profile of Jenji Kohan, who did Orange is the New Black and Glow. And I was out in LA, and they were pitching a new show. And I asked her who they were pitching it to. And she said, you know, to Facebook, to Amazon. I was like, Facebook? Facebook has TV now? I mean, it is a situation where I don't think anybody knows how things are going to settle down, but continually emerging platforms that produce shows. And honestly, all I care about is whether the shows are good. So I am just agnostic on these kinds of things. I mean, I don't like ads. I don't like product integration. I like good shows and I like original shows. I like for a variety of different kinds of people to be able to make TV shows so we can hear multiple stories. Those are my values. Whatever the TV industry is doing, you know, go with God, network executives. Just make the things that are interesting to write about is my feeling about it.
Now, you feel that you're in conversation all the time with all the various people writing about television and also the internet itself. You tweet a lot.
Yes.
You have a very strong social media presence, as I do not. And I wonder how that's nourishing, irritating, just what role it plays in your writing.
I think everyone knows the downsides of Twitter. It's
right.
Definitely a strange way to communicate. On the other hand, as a television critic, it's been definitely joyful and nourishing. I mean, one of the main things about Twitter is that it gives me access to a global television audience. And every few months, I just say, what's out there that I haven't noticed that's really good?
And it just pours in.
It just pours in, and I put it on a list, and I try to catch things. And so I end up seeing shows like Please Like Me, which is this wonderful Australian half-hour show by this guy, Josh Thomas. This is humane, funny mixture of comedy and drama. He's this young gay guy, and it has this unusual sense of humor and unusual treatment of mental illness. It's an Australian show. I would never have really caught up with it unless people had mentioned it to me. So part of the way I use the internet is trying to break out of my own bubble so it's not just the shows that the people that I know in person or at The New Yorker are talking about. But also, I actually I don't know. I learn a lot from being part of the watching people talk about TV online. It triggers thoughts. It's not as though I'm adopting people's ideas. It's more like there's this way in which you react against stuff. Like you see people debating a certain show and then it acts as a catalyst. I think I'm a kind of a social writer that way.
Now, how has Donald Trump influenced television, do you think?
How has Trump affected television? I mean, I think about different shows. I mean, one of my favorite recent shows is The Good Fight, which is this show on this extremely odd version of CBS called CBS All Access, which is the very Orwellian name for this hidden version of CBS. And that's a show that deals directly with Trump. And it's a very surreal, angry show about this law firm in Chicago responding to Trump. But I think it's been hard for shows to actually deal with him directly. You know, Pose, I wrote about Ryan Murphy, and they originally had a version of Pose that had Donald Trump as a character. Because Pose, which is about the Black and Latino gay ballroom scene in the 80s, Donald Trump was a major figure at the time. And he was originally going to be a character on the show. And Ryan Murphy basically decided late in the process, you know, no one wants to see him. We're going to cut him out of the show. So they actually just did not have him as a character. I think it depends on what people are making. I mean, there are shows like Chernobyl seems to me like a response to the Trump administration. But it has nothing to do with Trump. It's just that it's a show about people lying to you from the government. So in that way, it feels very relevant and modern, even though it's a horror show about Russia in the 1980s. But there are shows that have these strange mirror effects for the population in terms of reflecting particular anxieties. And they seem relevant in that way, even if they don't directly respond to Trump. But I think TV has always done that.
Emily, you have a busy life. You write. You watch tons of television. You have a couple of kids. You have a social life, et cetera. You used to have a life in which you read 900-page Victorian novels, serious literature, and were engaged in conversations about that. Is reading, serious reading, steady reading, getting squeezed out too much of the lives of people who would otherweise read them? How do you feel about that?
I mean, I wish I had more time to read. But I mean, these discussions about anxiety, about what's taking over people's attention span are just recurrent. And I can't make a big statement about that. I mean, I love reading novels and I love watching good television shows. And it just doesn't seem fruitful for me to compare the value of them. All I can say is that there are television shows that I've watched that have had the same kind of weight and depth for me as anything that I've ever read.
Emily Nussbaum, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Emily Nussbaum's new book is called I Like to Watch, Arguing My Way Through the TV Revolution. You can read everything she writes for us at newyorker.com.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.